Thank you for having me. Obviously, the talk title is The Fallacies of Cyber War and some of the things that I've thought about it. Always a topical moment. But just on a show of hands, does anyone actually recognize the wall? Maybe a discreet wink? All right, I got like three people who are like, yo, I recognize the wall, but I'm shy. You know, if there ever was an organization that knows irony in the U.S. government, it is the CIA. That's in the CIA's wall. And I think, you know, there's a lot of things that you can say about cyber war. And I'm going to use cyber war as a term non-ironically to sort of cloud the issue. But this is not a talk that's deliberately trying to cloud your heads. But it may do that by mistake. So you let me know at the end. Obviously, you know, the news of the world, when it's not getting hacked, is about cyber war. And I guess when it is getting hacked, it is also about cyber war. And you can see things like The Economist, you know, saying, you know, the mouse and the keyboard, the new weapons of conflict. It sounds dramatic and sells newspapers, I'm sure. But I also want to point out that there's quite a lot of very thorough real-world discussion on cyber war. Coming out of essentially what are social policy engines. CNAS is just one of these, and this is one that I chose, for example, to demonstrate that you know, you have Mike McConnell here, you have Dan Geer, you have a few other people who are discussing it from a standpoint of policy. And one of the things you're going to see, even in this, is all of the fallacies that I'm about to talk to you about. And you're going to see it repeated over and over again. You're going to hear silly, silly things from all these people, such as that, you know, the average size of malware is 150 lines. That can't possibly be true. And then, of course, when the Pentagon declares cyberspace a new warfare domain, by definition, that makes it a new warfare domain. It is the kind of announcement that everyone has to respond to in an actionable, positive way. So you can't ignore it because of those escalating risks of cyber attacks by hackers and stuff, as they say. And the background to all of this is you know, clearly LulzSec. The sun ran Solaris, as we now know. And the non-governmental groups and all the sort of flotsam and chaff that our friends, and we have some media friends in the audience today, feed on. Realistically is a very powerful part of what cyber war is, and it's going to remain that way probably for the foreseeable future, and I think needs to be, you know, you can look at LulzSec or at any of the modern hacking that happens as sort of part of this greater context. So here are the fallacies, and you're going to see them in every report you read from now on, because they're not going to watch this Usenix talk, I'm sorry. They won't, it's true. But you're going to still see these things everywhere you go, and now you and I will both be having a good laugh when they report it with a very straight face. They will say, cyber war is asymmetric, meaning it is effective against large players, it is done with little money, it has a big bang for the buck, it, you know, essentially like guerrilla warfare, which was introduced against Napoleon back in Spain. That's why it's guerrilla, because it's cool in Spanish, right? Cyber war is non-kinetic. You're going to see that a lot. You'll see it in the CNAS report. You'll see it all over the place. Non-kinetic means we still have to blow stuff up with high ordnance. It means people didn't die when you hacked stuff. It's sort of in the virtual world. Virtual means not real. That's what non-kinetic means. And you're going to hear that all the time. And then, of course, cyber war is not attributable, right? And you hear this mostly from people who think about things only realistically because they've also been thinking about nuclear weapons a lot, right? You know, this is the not the attribution is something that you do when you care who blew who up with what nuke. And you're going to see this all the time. So, you know, now that these fallacies are endemic, but the talk is not necessarily about the people who think these things, although I think that's funny too. But why do security groups actually do it? Why do people think these things? You get led down the rosy path of asymmetric and non-kinetic and non. And so the first one I want to address is that cyber war actually is very, very kinetic. And I think this is something that's fallen in the past year, right? Like when I started saying this stuff a year ago, everyone's like, no, you are full of it, Dave. And frankly, go back to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It was more interesting. But these days, it turns out that people realize that kinetic does not just mean explosions, instant death. You know, I can see it from my little tri-finder and boop, psh, stuff blows up, right? That's not realistically what Cyber War is about. Everyone here lives in a big, fragile city, I'm betting. I personally live in Miami Beach, which is about a foot above sea level, right? When our pumps fail, it's a dramatic event in that I'm boating down my street through my lawn, right? So, the bonus fact of logistics failure in any modern city, any kind of logistics failure, is that it includes explosions and instant death, right? And I say bonus in quotes because it's not a bonus for those of you who have experienced lack of sewage. And the resultant fact of that, because everyone lives in cities, is that you can change a nation state's behavior with cyber war, right? You can, for example, say, you know, I noticed your pumps didn't work. Maybe we can help you with that, right? Like, things can change. And logistics failure can be anything, right? Your refrigeration, you know, trucks didn't get to the right place, right? The fact is, most cities are just-in-time delivery events these days. And, you know, WikiLeaks obviously is an important implementation of this. You know, if a nation state is a body of secrets when it comes down to it, and things can become unbodies of secrets quite quickly, as we found out, even at the just secret level. The wiki in WikiLeaks is the part that everyone ignores, which I think is really funny, because it's really the genius behind the whole thing, right? The leaks is Cryptome. Everyone's been able to leak. You can leak stuff by leaving it on the street in the rain. But the wiki part is the analysis. That's the hard part. He says, I have a body of data that I know has something of interest, but I don't know what. And this is the theme you're going to see throughout all of Cyber War. I mean, the reality is he understood Cyber War better than almost anybody who wrote for CNES, right? And it's pretty obvious because of all the pressure he's under now, right? I mean, you know you're smart when they've got like an ankle ring on you. Nation states really are just one implementation of that, because his target could easily have been whaling companies. It could easily have been oil companies. It could easily have been the Red Cross. I don't know. So when you look at doing kinetic things, power stations the most obvious because it's what people think about now. But because it's what people think about now, it's really not the most useful, right? Like logistics of all kinds are useful, factories of all kinds. And you're definitely going to see people talking about nuclear power in the next 10 years and 30 years until we all decide not to use nuclear power, perhaps not. But you're going to start seeing even funnier things like the smart grid, which is the most Orwellian phrase anyone's ever used, right? No doubt there's papers here about the smart grid. Anyone know any? I can't think of any. But the smart grid is a grid of things that they put in all of your devices. And in California, it's going to be mandatory, of course, because that's how Nazi-fornia works. But the goal is to prevent brownouts and do your power allocation in a smart, centralized manner, right? You want to be the communist China of power management, which is genius. The unfortunate thing is price pressure means you're going to do it with chips that cost about a half cent, right? So the smartness has to be very, very minimal. We're talking ant-level smarts at best. And that doesn't lead its way to security, right? Security is complex, big, and expensive. It is not cheap, inefficient, and fun. Well, it'll be fun for me, but it won't be fun for those of you who live in California. And the other side of the things, I mean, you saw the black hat talk, no doubt, on unlocking a car. Probably the most boring thing you can do to a car, because, you know, there's plenty of people out there who've been looking at cars in a way where you want to make the car go fast at a certain time, like a Prius, and not stop. Right now, Prius does it by mistake sometimes. But the reality is that this is a very extreme danger for those of us who drive cars, which here in California, I think, is everybody, right? And, you know, in planes, boats, trains, automobiles, you know, there have been a surprising amount of planes containing nuclear Iranian scientists that have gone down in the past few years. Does anyone notice this weird habit that they have? This stuff's forensically impossible to track down. It's completely, there's no way you're going to find a team. You're going to pull up this plane that just went down in the middle of Kajikistan, and you're going to say, well, there were a bunch of Iranian scientists in here. It could have been mechanical failure, because the last time we maintained this plane was in 1950. But we might as well rip apart its electronics and send it off to a specialized team who will charge us more than the plane was worth to figure out if this was Trojaned by somebody, right? And first you have to find that mysterious team of who can actually look at plane electronics and do forensics. Your chances of getting caught if you've executed something like this are basically nil, because there's no one who can look at it and recover the data and do analysis at that level for anything reasonably approaching a price. You know, the big thing that changed everyone's mind this year, though, of course, was Stuxnet, right? They won a pony for it. Like, we destroyed your nukes. How's that for hacking? Works for me, right? And people talk about it as if it's a Trojan. And this is partially because the media is driven by antivirus companies who like to look at everything as if they're Trojan families, right? Like, that's not how life works in real life, but here's what they were looking at. They're like, whoa, check it out. A Trojan with O'Day. Who would have thought? It's amazing. You know? Because they've never seen O'Day before. It's great. The Link O'Day. Now, that was a great O'Day, which got you all around on the USB network. Task scheduler on Vista and Windows 7 was, an extremely crafty little exploit that got you local admin or local system from any user. The Windows keyboard exploit for the lower stuff, like obviously you have Task Scheduler for Vista, you have Windows keyboard for XP, so you're kind of covered up on stuff. again, operating a Ring Zero, aka system, as any user. And Print Spooler, which everyone was like, oh, I don't know if it's an O'Day or not. It was in like a Russian magazine a while back. And I'm like, well, did it work? Was it patched? Then it's O'Day, right? Like, so let's count it as four. And what people did in the media, which I thought was great, was they tried to add up the price of the, you know, Trojan by looking at the price of the O'Day, which they made up. They pulled all these numbers right out of their butt. And they're like, oh, it's $1 million just for the O'Day. You know, and I don't know. The answer is who cares, right? Because the reality of the situation is that Stuxnet is not a wooden horse. It's not a Trojan. None of these things are Trojans. People look at them and they're like, let's analyze the Trojan and the command and control center. That is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous way to do it. That's like analyzing IBM based on your touch book or whatever it is you have in front of you. I guess everyone here has an Apple, right? Like, yeah, pretty much. All right. No, the girl next to me in the previous talk was like running some sort of special Zimian thing with like IRC and Emacs and stuff. And I'm like, all right, now we're talking. So. But the real Stuxnet obviously is a collection of things. And some of those things are not people who write software under contract such that you get a Trojan. Some of those things are people who do analysis, which I think is the more important thing. And I think people miss the message of Stuxnet, which wasn't, I blew up your nukes, I'm cool. The real message was, I can take out any factory you have at any time that I choose, right? And that's a much scarier message. And if you thought about that message to your own company, or your own country, or your own organization, any factory that makes cars, factory that makes baby bottles, or factory that, you know, delivers your food or whatever. Because your food comes from a factory, let's face it. Even if you, like, I know we've all seen the Whole Foods, it's getting real in the Whole Foods parking lot thing, because this is California and we're all hippies. But that's all food from a factory as well, right? It literally gets plopped down on an assembly line and then plopped with stuff on it. That can all go away. That was the message, right? So, an important message, perhaps. Aurora, right? Again, people talked about it like it was a Trojan. It was a cyber attack which began and ended. And the funny thing here was, how do you get hackers out of your system after they've been there for 6 months? Right? You cannot. Like, no hacker on Earth has ever been kicked out of a network that he's been on for 6 months. He knows so much about the thing. He's obsessed. He's way more obsessed than your IT group. Right? Like these are people with OCD as their like first line of in their CV. So they listed the companies and they could have just picked them at random, right? They're like, how many Fortune 500 companies compromised? Answer, 500. Right? Simple. Right? Like, it is not, this is not a complex question, but I did think it was extremely hilarious that it was RSA saying these things. And they have all these great questions, right? Like, how good is the traditional defense mechanisms? Well, clearly not very good. Right? What is it you sell again? Ah. What control do I have over what my employees do at work and at home? Well, until we get the magic life monitoring that was discussed in the keynote, probably not so control-y. What sort of data is stolen from the corporation? All the data, right? Like, those were the answers to the questions, and they were obvious answers even back then. Is there anything that can be done to identify and seal all the gaps? Perhaps buying one of those secure ID tokens would have helped. I don't know, but and then what you get, and the news sort of sits around and just sort of lists companies that got hit, right? And just lists and lists and lists and lists of companies. Oh, this one, that one, this one, that one, this one. It gets really boring, right? Because you eventually assume they all got hit, right? I would have to hope you do. And that you also have to assume that they're all still hit. Because the truth is that no one can get kicked out, right? I have to work hard as a hacker to get kicked out. That would take a lot of work for me, right? Cleanup is tough. And 30 of them got publicly humiliated. Every quote should include Joseph Stalin, and it's true, right? Like, quantity is a quality all of its own, right? When you have all of the world's information, you then have to collect and store it somewhere, right? It's a mission. I think it's a corporate mission for someone too. That's right. I think they're in the other room over there recruiting. Here they are. Right? They have a new approach to China, and China has a new approach to them. It's good. But this is the downside, really, when you do get caught, is that it makes your supply-side attacks harder, right? You know, it does play into the political arena when you have all the world's information. And the same thing's true with Google, right? I mean, there's no reason that countries should feel comfortable doing business with a company in the States like Google. Chinese companies, whatever, and that's why Baidu exists. And supply-side attacks get complex. They're more complex than it looks. So that's, you know, there's kinetic amounts of it, there's and the attributable part of it, right? And I think we've touched a little bit on it, but the easiest way to attribute things is to be everywhere, right? If I'm everywhere, then I see everything. And there's a difference between being everywhere and being anywhere, right? Those are two very different concepts. Because lulzsec can be anywhere, but they can't be everywhere, which is the simple example. And what everyone will say is they'll say, well, to be everywhere, I'm just going to attack the command and control, right? Because that's the traditional military or intelligence response to learning things about your opponent, is to attack the command and control, to attack the nervous center. They'll say, I'll attack the nervous center, that thing. That is a lot easier said than done. So what actually happens is you better get lucky, right? Unless you've invested an obscene amount of resources, you're not going to hit the command and control for lulzsec. And they're on the small end of this. But what you do see, and I collected some of these, and I was looking for the ones about Israel and nukes, but those were a little harder to find. Shady rat. Who comes up with that? I know who came up with it, obviously, but it's terrible. It's terrible, I guess, is the point. And I was going to insert story after story about attribution. It can be China, it can be Israel, it can be, you know, everybody has, you know, at the point where the register or, you know, other news groups know who was hacking you, then you have to assume the internal analysis teams of various companies and countries know who it was, right? Like, attribution does happen. It happens pretty much by the time it hits the news. And the other sort of side of attribution is it really isn't like all other weapons are obviously attributable, right? They don't come with a magic here's who hit me button. And we've had to work really hard to make this true even a little bit for most of the other things. And sort of this is how we sort of develop our concepts behind mutual shared destruction and all sorts of great things that we've lived under for many years. So the attribution thing, I think, is something that we're coming to grips with the fact that it's not as true as it looks. And the real big one here is the asymmetric one. You know, you're going to see everyone say, Cyborg's asymmetric, therefore we need to do X, right? I don't think it's asymmetric at all, right? And here's some examples of who says that. Here's Bruce Schneier. I mean, I was originally going to say it was all like old men with beards who say it's asymmetric. But I actually don't know if he has a beard. He does have a beard. Is it a big beard? All right. It's trimmed. All right. Either way, it's a beard. Okay. In this way, cyber attacks can be part of guerrilla warfare campaign. I don't think so, because it's hard to do cyber attacks from a jungle. And then here's Martin Libicki, and I've made many interesting posts about him on my mailing list. But the reality is, you'll see him say that things are asymmetric constantly. And he's kind of pulled back a little bit on this lately. Not due to me, just from his own reasons. William Lin, he sort of clumps it up, you know, surface-to-surface missiles, cyber capabilities, and anti-satellite technologies. Anti-satellite technologies is the kind of asymmetric that I think I would love to have one of, right? At the point where I personally have an anti-satellite technology, that would be awesome, you know? Or satellite technology. Any of this stuff is... So, I mean, at the price point, is there an asymmetric, I guess, is the point. But basically everyone's going to say, and probably everyone in this room, before they came to the talk, and, of course, if they weren't shy, would have said, yes, I think cyber war is asymmetric because I think I could do it. Everyone thinks they can do it, right? It's like modern art, you know. It does look easy. And why is it that people think that? Because you've read in the newspaper on many a website. I mean, no one reads the newspaper, let's face it. That's what Twitter's for. But breaking into machines seems relatively cheap, right? You're like, I mean, that... Topiary guy is 19, or is he 18? All right, regardless, it's not like he's got a Porsche. It's relatively cheap. And if you price out, like you're like thinking in your head, oh, I want to buy this, I want to buy that, you can do it probably for about $10 million a year, US dollar. I mean, this year, next year, who knows what US dollar is worth. But it'll get you into wherever you want, right? This is the anywhere side of the equation. It's not the everywhere side of the equation. And finding O-Days does cost money. It just doesn't cost crazy money, right? People write a fuzzer, they find O-Day, they write it up, they're like, oh, I'm awesome, right? That happens over and over, and then they, you know, learn things. And the hacker infrastructure itself, right? You're like, I need to buy some servers, I need a couple sat phones, I'm going to buy those with bitcoins, that'll be awesome. You know, but it's not crazy expensive, really. And the bandwidth is essentially free. If you think about the kind of bandwidth you're going to do, even when you're doing very large exfiltration, I mean, you're doing 2 terabytes out of Booz Allen or whatever it is that they did, that was probably free in terms of transit costs, unless you're on that British sim, like our keynote speaker. These are the sort of market equations that spawned all of banking spyware. They're like, we can break into whoever we feel like, you know, a bunch of people, who knows, random people, for basically nothing, then get some money, and that's profit. But why are they wrong, right? Why, when I say, well, obviously it's easy to break in anywhere, what then is the hidden cost that makes it wrong that this is asymmetric? This is probably what's going through your heads right now, right? Why, didn't I just say I was full of it? It's a good question. So there's a couple things here with carrier class expense tickets, aka they cost as much as an aircraft carrier. In case you thought I meant another kind of carrier. And one of those is maintenance, right? Because anyone who has ever released software knows that your maintenance cycle on any software is about 10 years long. It's just as long when you hack into a machine, right? Like I hack into, I don't know, let's say I hack into anyone here's machine. You're probably going to throw that machine out in 3 years, and I'm going to have to migrate to your new machine. And then I have to migrate all of your email accounts again. And then I have to, you know, that's a lot of work, right? And I'm not trying to whine about it. I'm just saying that there's a maintenance cost here that any reasonable person is going to be afraid of. And the other one, obviously, is analysis, right? Organizing all of the world's information, which I think is a fantastic motto or drive for any organization, probably more than three, is a big job, right? You know, there's a great story, fantastic literature, called I Know an Old Woman Who Swallowed a Fly, and she swallows like a, you know, cat and then a goat or whatever and then a horse, and then she's full. Literature that I read these days. But the reality is swallowing horses is very hard to do. And once you've done it, it takes a special kind of team to do something about it. How'd that work for you guys without kids? Made a lot of sense, right? All right. And what you end up doing is picking up a few basic books on data mining and thinking, great, I'm going to solve my problems with data mining, right? I heard some laughs from people who do data mining. It's good. The thing about that is, even if you're fantastic at data mining, you also have to do something inside your organization that can take advantage of that data. And it's just not as simple as it looks. And one of the first problems you're going to run into is targeting, right? Like, who do I hack next? How do I get to them? All these questions, right? It looks simple. You swivel the thing and you push the button and the exploit goes out and it gets the guy. This is a completely fuzzy problem. There's way too much data to really analyze, and it generally comes down to human passion, right? Someone has to be passionate about that particular organization, getting into them and doing something about it properly. It splits into two types of targeting analysis, right? There's the operational targeting, right? Like, that network is important. I must be there. This is what they're running. This is what they will be running. I noticed them upgrade the last five times, right? It's trend analysis. It's a lot of things. There's a humongous quantity of data here that you have to analyze to do this right. And the second one, obviously, is large scale exploit development targeting. Everyone right now is like, whoa, Adobe exploits, awesome, right? Totally boring next year. Everyone's going to forget about them. We'll move on to something else like virtual machine exploits again. You're going to see a bunch of papers on virtual machine exploits even, I think, at this conference. This sort of forethought, and you have to get it right. You're essentially looking at a stock market's worth of information and guessing, BlackBerry, who cares? I need to go another direction to Android, right? Like, you have to get that right 5 years ahead of time because you have a whole suite of tools you got to pour it all the way up there. So that is a very difficult thing because exploit development doesn't get done without good, dissemblers, debuggers, a whole train of logistical stuff that happens before you can write things that actually, you know, get you on the box and provide calculators if you're a busted caddy or something. I'm not a busted caddy, in case you're curious. But the other side of the story is that in order to build these tools, most attackers, they write exploits, right? When you think a hacker, when you look at, you know, Stuxnet, for example, you're thinking, hey, they found some exploits, right? And you'll see this over and over again. Good hackers do write exploits. and then you'll find that better hackers actually will find holes in the underlying frameworks, right? Like Apache's Java implementation, for example. Or the fact that Microsoft's latest groundbreaking drag-and-drop software creation tools don't do security at all. So that's actually a more expensive thing to do. Right, and it kind of reaches for a longer time, and it's sort of a bigger chunk out of your budget. And then you find that you get better attackers who will find holes in the underlying math of the problem. Right, and these are obscenely expensive things to do that require 50-year investment cycles and are generally beyond almost everybody. And in order to do them, you need a computer. Right, and I don't really consider any of the things that you've got in front of you computers. You know, much as people think of their phones as pocket computers, honestly, I think they're really pocket calculators, right? A real computer is massively parallel, right? It is parallel to the point where you stop thinking of it as parallel, like your brain. No one thinks my brain is a parallel computer, right? No, you don't. It has a distributed data storage database, right? There's a data storage API in your brain that does stuff. It stores lots of data. It stores it in lots of different ways, and it has replications and backups that you don't have to think about. And as a general purpose API, right? Like, Google's computer can drive a car, That's as general purpose as it gets, right? It wasn't designed to drive a car originally, but now it drives cars. That's pretty cool. We could all use that. Got to get to Whole Foods somehow, right? And there's people trying to build computers, right? Azure, nobody knows enough about that to know if it's going to turn into a real computer, is really the downside of it. Because it could also go the other way and become a special purpose VPS hosting provider, like a Rackspace, essentially. And depends on how they work it out. It has some good APIs, I'm sure. Google very clearly has the world's most foremost computer. And there's a reason they're here trying to recruit people, because they need someone to actually write things for it. And it's very, very likely you'll say Amazon, also a computer, has almost all the same APIs, is parallel to the point where I don't have to think about it. Not quite as smooth from an API standpoint, but pretty darn close. And obviously there's NSA and a few other organizations that probably have computers as well. But one thing you'll note is that none of those computers are in any other country, right? Like, those are computers built here in San Francisco, probably. And that means if you're trying to do real computer security work, aka do real math, you should probably start building a computer. Or you can, you know, pick one up on the sly, which is why attacks against these three companies make complete sense, right? Like, the attack against Google is not necessarily an attack against Google. It's an attack to get a computer. I need one. I want to run some jobs, right? And that can be a very valuable thing. So I wanted to, you know, I have a bit of a strategy section here on cyber war, which you can either agree with or disagree with, as you will. And the general theme that my first mentor taught me was, whoever knows the network best controls the network. He's like, it's very simple. If you know it better than the IT staff, you will control it. There's nothing they can do. There's nothing you can do. That's just the equation. That's how it works. You know, and this is also true for web applications. And what people derive from this process is scan, understand a bit about it, right, and then attack it, right? They're like, I'm going to attack it. Attack that network. That's my best Bush voice. And then what you get is a lot of research papers on, I have some sort of big problem. Let me automate it. Right, and this is both research papers from industry, academia, everywhere. But the thing about automation and scanning in this industry is that none of them work, right? And I don't just mean, I mean, occasionally they do work, right? As Halvar says, even a blind chicken does find seeds sometimes. But none of the problems that anyone's trying to solve are really that linear. They generally tend to be extremely exponential. And I'm using that in sort of a fuzzy way, but these are the sorts of things you see in the automated space today in computer security, right? You'll see vulnerability scanners. In order for me to run some of my exploits, it takes me 18 hours. Like, 18 hours is a normal time to run a modern exploit. That's a long time against one box. And then at the end, it might say, sorry, didn't work. Right, so this whole scanner idea is, you know, people get value out of it. It doesn't mean they're not full of value. It just means they don't work. Static analysis, there's some great talks on static analysis in the other room, by the way. That doesn't work either. And it's not going to work anytime soon. And by soon, I mean next 50 years. I think we have some talks next tomorrow on static analysis, too. You can let them know. Web application scanners, those don't work at all. They sell for lots of money in the market, but they really just don't do anything. You know, people are like, well, we solve part of the problem. That's true, right? You solve the very, very bottom level of the problem, right? But if you look at bugs in web applications and you classify them with could have been found by a static analysis tool or could have potentially, theoretically even, been found by a scanner, the answer almost always is no, right? Like, my company does security audits for a living, and almost always we're like, yeah, the scanners, and there's just no way to do it without manual analysis. And this is true with, you know, when you combine them. Like, uh-oh, no, our tool is both scanny and static analysis. Right now they have two problems, right? Because that doesn't, now you have two things that don't work together. And people will disagree with me all day on this, right? But, I mean, the reality is there's no security component to static analysis. There is a QA component, usually. C cannot be security analyzed, C++, PHP, name it. So any of these other scanners that you people come up with, generally the feeling is it sounds good on paper, but in reality does not work, right? Like the, and I'll just give you one basic example of static analysis problem, which is that no human being can understand the results, right? Like I have a whole team of very specialized people in software security. And when you look at some of the results from static analysis tools, it's still going to take them a day per finding to verify the finding, maybe, right? Like, and so you came up with 100 findings, that's 100 days, and frankly, it's easier for me to find some bugs of our own. And so that's part of the part of the sort of strategy of this stuff, is that automation's not that simple in this space. And being able to handle loops would be cool if you're doing static analysis. That'd be cool. I can't do that yet. So losing an O-day. People look at losing an O-day and they think, oh, well, I lost an O-day. But in the modern world, losing an O-day means you lost all the hosts you owned with it, and you lost all the rootkits you installed on them, and possibly all the data you pulled out from them, right? Like, that's all known now. Because you live in a world in your head of instant paranoia where, you know, I've been caught, therefore everything I've ever done is compromised. Or you should, anyway. So that's an important thing. And one thing, the other thing we noticed in the strategy space is that for very complex bug classes, like not the bug classes you're fuzzing out, because I know there's paper after paper on slightly better fuzzers, but nobody uses those bugs, right? So the for things that are complex enough, there really isn't, there's no connection between the bugs you find and the bugs everyone else finds. They're completely disparate, and they sort of die via completely random attrition based on someone looked at that code, said it's horrible, and rewrote it, and added their own bugs, but not the bugs you had originally. And I have some metrics in here. I'm a huge believer in metrics because I guess Dan Geer converted me at one point. And so for 20 kernel bugs since 05, 10 of them are left, and the rest died just due to code refactoring. You didn't see advisories, you saw, sorry, we rewrote that and it has a whole new thing now. Which I think is interesting, right? I mean, the fact is that bell curve of attrition is interesting. I don't know how the metrics become interesting. They're interesting to me. Attackers use metrics a lot more than defenders for some reason. And of course, the other metric we have is that on a countrywide scale for us, it's about 2 cents per IP to do remote work, right? Or 0.2 cents, which is actually a lot of money. We're trying to drive that down to reasonable numbers. Maybe your budgets are bigger. So again, why do security groups think it's asymmetric after having looked at all this kinds of data? And this is what we continually drive down to. You know, why do attackers still win? Why does LulzSec still exist? Why does Aurora exist? Why does Stuxnet exist? How is this happening? Right? You're like, I built this amazing system. It makes uranium or whatever it is. And this is constantly what I see, these fuzzy-haired rebels driving away in their tiny little ship with this big flashy explosion noise thing. That's annoying, right? Like, and because it keeps happening over and over again, and sequel after sequel, Aurora 3, Return of the Shady Rat, the strategists and policymakers think of it as a feature of the cyber domain, right? Michael Hayden, in his Black Hat keynote, was saying, this is a feature. We are the Poland of the internet. Or we built the internet like Poland. Whatever it is, you can go check out his talk all by yourself. The reality is it's not true. Currently, the offensive teams are successful because they have a better strategy. That's why they're winning, right? That's why LulzSec exists and Stuxnet and all these others. And right now, the defenders tend to look like this. For whatever reason, that's what they wear. And you hear these excuses. You hear this over and over. You'll hear it from any industry person who's tried to do defense. They'll say, well, you only need one good attacker, but all our defenders have to be good. You know, or users will click on anything. What can I do? Or I have resource constraints. I have to do it for 5 cents, and I have to secure everyone's smart grid with that. Which is true. And hence they start thinking, the problem is intractable. The problem of defense on the internet is intractable, is what they're saying, which is not true. Right? What's happening is there's cultural weaknesses and technological weaknesses, which I'll go into. And the first one is that the standard weapon that people use is law enforcement. which is almost exclusively useful against attackers who have financial motives. If your motto is get rich or die trying, then yes, every country can take you down. Because you have a very easy, you have the handle that they can hold, right? The finances. This one, not so much, right? Sneaky hacker. I love that phrase. This happened in China based on the fact that someone hacked Foxconn, whose employees were having a bit of a depressing day, and they kept jumping off the buildings. This is where they make your iPhones and those little cute Macs everyone has, and probably this Dell I'm using. And the 514, 514, 514 number is also specific to a Chinese number gram. It means like death or something, I don't know. But so definitely that's going to be a much harder hacker to hit, right? Because they probably, you know, that kind of hacking is not hacking that you're going to track down by tracing credit card numbers. And the other side of the story is the attackers generally will read every academic paper written in their space, every online news article, everything possibly ever presented, but they will not share anything that they do outside of very close circles. And this is actually a phrase from Brian Snow from the NSA, who speaks of it in a slightly different way. They might just read it for humor, because the reality is the academic community is not a serious player in modern information security, right? Like that, what was it, ROP paper? Who read that paper? That paper was hilarious. I'm sorry. Generally, these papers are bandied about, especially the static analysis papers and that, all those sort of papers, as humorous articles on hacker news sites. And maybe this could change. I don't know. And you see these education timelines where, you know, defenders get taught new techniques by the attackers, right? All of a sudden, returning to libc code is a new amazing thing, or, you know, encoding your shell code is a new amazing thing, or any of this stuff. And so they build a new defensive technique against it, and then deployment of that takes some time. And then by the time it's universally deployed, the attackers have moved on to VMware escapes or something. So the sort of train, the time train here, right? You don't see it the other way around, right? Attackers aren't learning new techniques from the defenders and thinking, hey, that would be cool. That's a good idea, right? And in general, the marketing prism that everyone sees this technology through is very damaging, right? I mean, every time someone says the word script kiddie, you know they are dumber than whoever they're talking about, right? Because actually being a script kiddie is really hard. It's incredibly difficult. It's a skilled occupation, like nuclear scientist, right? It's not the sort of thing you pick up over lunch, you know? It's a dedication, right? Like Kung Fu, perhaps, which is what they like to think they're doing. Although, in reality, less buff, usually. So, but in general, because, especially the AV community, and I know there's none of them here, because they're not crying yet, but they look down on their opponent. They think that they are more worthy than their opponent for many reasons. And it's not the case, and it does not help them. Let's just put it that way. And as a consulting company, one thing that we find often is just a complete inability to understand the impact of O-Day. But this expands out to not just companies, but whole communities, right? The whole community does not understand the impact of O-Day. They cannot grasp it. It is too hard, right? Is there anything I can tell you about a platform that will make you abandon it? It's a simple question, right? I can ask it going into any client, and like, if I tell you 8 bad things here, will you say, all right, this thing is completely destroyed. We need to get rid of it and replace it with something good. And one of the things, you know, it's not immunity always saying this stuff. It's often everybody else, right? CertUS, and we were saying this to our clients as well, but CertUS wrote it in a much better way. They said, clientless SSL VPN products break web browser domain-based security models. How many of you guys are typing right now on your laptops through some sort of SSL VPN? None of you now, right, obviously, because you're listening to this awesome talk. But if you weren't, if it was like a static analysis talk or something, right, then you could be checking your email over Juniper or many other products, extremely popular SSL VPNs. None of those work. They don't even work at all. Not even a little bit. They completely break the security model. And they're very well everywhere, right? Like any company bigger than 1,000 people has one. I'm not calling out Juniper. Every company has one, right? Like Cisco, I think, has one. Anyone who makes anything has an SSL VPN, it seems. And this is US cert. This isn't even us. They're like, this does not work. Breaks fundamental security mechanisms. What can we possibly tell you that will have you not use them? Is there anything we can tell you? The answer is no, right? So yeah, that's not going to help you. And browser makers are the same way. None of these browsers are written in Java. Why is that? Right? It's retarded, basically. Chrome was written from ground up, and they decided to write it in like C++ and just cobble together all the libraries they could ever find that did anything useful. I don't know why. Does that sound like a secure design to you? It's the most secure browser, right? You're all using it? Good for you. Right? This is the other thing they did. Native client system. Has anyone heard of this? Yep. It executes x86 code in a jail, in a little jail. That's going to work, right? No. No, obviously not, right? So, but they did at least have it assessed. They're like, we're going to have some people look at it for, you know, $1,000 each, and we'll see if they find anything. They're like, you know, they got up to issue 63. And they're like, well, good thing we found all those. Now those are fixed, so we can go ahead with it. Right? I mean, there was no metric here where they said, listen, at this level of resources, we should not have found anything. Right? There was nothing anyone could tell them about the system that would have them give it up and stop. Bad idea. That's pretty funny, really. You see it in much bigger examples here, right? Like VMware and the National Security Agency. You'll see people do this all the time because it's so economical. You want to build a system where it can put, you know, classified data, and it doesn't have to be like U.S. security classified, but any kind of important data, next to systems that process, you know, less important data, less securely. And I want to separate them with a hypervisor. Sounds good, right? Sounds very similar to that native client thing that we just talked about. Let's get a patent. And what they did was they had a virtual air gap. And what we demonstrated was that with slightly more money and effort, what you get is a virtual wooden bridge and work between the two, which is nice, obviously, for us. Not so much for people who deployed trusted systems. this is a talk that Kostya gave, I guess, in 2009. And you still see quite a lot of these days. And the reason... So the cultural patterns, I think, also sort of derive from the fact that the attacking community is mature. It's well organized, and it's highly motivated. And people say highly motivated by money. I don't think it's necessarily motivated by money. I think attackers make decent money. I don't think that's what motivates them. This Mr. Morris guy was back in, I think, 88. FIRST, which is an organization... that does incident response and all that stuff, 89. FRAC was in 85, right? These are old organizations by our internet standards. Even I'm ancient by our internet standards. And Bill Gates caught on in 2002, right? Didn't go the other way around, right? You don't hear someone going, hey, security will be important from the defensive side. No, it came out of the offensive teams because they're older. And this, I think, is... the probably best cartoon that they came up with in the past little while on the subject. I think I used the F word in a presentation here for the first time. But, I mean, basically what they're saying is, and I'm one of these 90s hackers who focuses on memory corruption, there's generations of hackers out there, of the attacking community, the generations have sort of matured. There's distinct lines. That's how old this thing is, right? There was CDC back in the day. You know, thank you, Dildog. We get claps for that. Okay. And in between that were people who used buffer overflows and sort of made it a passion and art and really took it to where it could go. And now you have a whole new set of things going on, right? This Web 2.0 hacking that actually works. It's important. And you can see some of the just the general themes of this stuff in this really nice thing this dude put together, a little Flash app. There's no cross-site scripting in that Flash app, by the way. It's perfect. And as a corporation, I mean, the cultural institutions that you have lumped information security right into IT security, right? But they don't do any sort of data classification. If you go to no corporation has anything beyond, we think this is, you know, sensitive, right? Like, people have to sign an NDA to get to it, pretty much. You don't have a bigot list. You don't have anything real. And what you end up with is if any attacker goes in and then uses your internal Google appliance to find, they can find everything, right? Anything from your like VPN keys to your everybody's names and addresses and everything, passwords, you know, external, internal network lists, all your internal software. Data classification's hard, and then data segmentation's really hard, and no one's doing it. And until you do it, you can't do cloud computing right. Because you're not going to be able to say, hey, I want my mail server on a different cloud center than I want my random SharePoint servers. Those have probably two completely different security regulations. And you're going to merge them all together in one happy space. Right, so that's, realistically, everyone seems to try it, and this is where they get owned, and that'll happen for the next 5 years. It'll be really funny. And this is where the wooden bridge comes back, because people assume that their hypervisor is secure now, because this is patched, right? That's real cool, because we can't understand O-Day, even to this day. And because of the cultural weaknesses, we get these technological weaknesses, which is the story of software and security, but they're all sort of deriving from the cultural side of it. And a large part of it is that defenders are not surprising attackers, right? The whole Einstein project is like an explanation in 90s technologies. It's people exploring their past. I used to wear the total awesomest clothing. I think I was in flannels pretty much throughout the 90s. But while I was doing that, the technologies that are behind Einstein 3 were really popular, right? And they're just deploying this stuff. I mean, this was a 2009 report, but regardless, I'm sure it's deployed now and providing amazing results, just truly groundbreaking. The reality, being on the network layer is silly, right? NetWitness just got bought for astounding amounts of money, probably because it sells lots of network hardware and stuff, which is it probably makes lots of money. I mean, the money thing doesn't make sense, but in terms of actually worky-worky, if you think about it, what could be noisier than the network layer? Nothing. The network layer contains as much noise as is possible and as little actual signal as possible. And that's where everyone is still going, right? It is essentially like listening to Alanis Morissette nonstop in the security space forever, right? That is what we have here. Every time you see a technology that says, well, I take all the network data and then I do stuff, right? You should be like, that's so ironic. But you don't. You buy it. What can I say? And here, very few organizations have released any real day O-Day statistics. So here's the ones we released in 2007. I don't think they've changed too much. And I can't be bothered to go find out because metrics are hard. But the average O-Day lifetime was a year. That meant if I found a bug, if I invested the time in finding a bug, it lasted a year on average, right? Could be 10 years, I don't know. But on average, a year. Shortest lifetime was 99 days, which is still plenty of time for me. Longest lifetime at the time was 3 years. I think that's gone up by quite a bit. It's a pretty cool curve, I'm sure. But nonetheless, the reality is, these numbers sort of speak to the economics of the situation. Your consulting engagements, when you hire, some of you work in companies, and when you hire a consulting company to find bugs in your application, and you think, well, our budget's about $15,000. That sounds a lot to us, right? Let's say, whatever reason, we want to splurge and buy about 200 hours of consulting, of which about 40% are documentation, right? Our finding was that it's about, on average, 451 hours to find a good O-Day. See? He fell right over. The fact that those numbers, one of them is bigger than the other, tells you something immediately. It says that your consulting does not address your problem. at all, even close, which is what happened to Cloudburst, because they turned a team of scientists against VMware before they decided to release the trusted computing platform. They just didn't turn them on for long enough, or they would have found the stuff, right? They would have said, this is broken. We need to readdress the problem. It's not going to work. So the job of someone like me is to beat the SDL. It is not to beat a particular DLL or piece of software. It is to beat the SDL. And I tend to succeed. And hence, the resulting state of play is that the SDL of all the major vendors is completely broken. From Microsoft to Google to name your vendor, do they sell things, then their SDL is broken. In some cases, they didn't even try, like Apple. But in some cases, they tried. And then what you see is that the internet's command and control itself gets compromised because of that, right? When there is nothing secure to build on, the organizations as a whole fall apart. Do you think you can trust the root DNS for the United States? Why would you think that? They built it on normal stuff, normal things, normal people use SSH. There's just no way. And every global PKI system we've ever tried to deploy has fallen, right? The fact that someone managed to get this close to Red Hat and Fedora before they got caught was a three-day news blip. But look how far they got. What makes you think their second try didn't get in, or the better team's first try got in and they were like, yo, we're kicking you out, right? Like, this is a very funny thing, right? This, people are like, oh, we released a script designed to detect potentially compromised OpenSSH stuff. Okay. OpenSSH wouldn't be my choice to Trojan, but at least they'll get to catch that one. Debian.org got compromised. I mean, perhaps you guys remember when kernel.org shells were all the rage. But when you have no secure OS or anything else, browsers, right? The security of Mozilla.com, I'm sure, is perfect. And then people are even selling things that subvert SSL, right? Like, this is just an off-the-shelf thing that someone did. He's like, if you happen to have a root certificate, you can just plug this stuff in here, put your certificate here, and you're good to go. Right? That implies there's a market of people with root certificates, right? Has anyone ever looked at your root certificates in your browser? They're pretty big. Yeah, it's pretty crazy, right? Yeah, it's crazy. So I think it's funny that people think that even with all the stuff going on, that there's emails that you can send to people that are not going to be read in interesting places, right? Like, that's what it means to have control of the trusted computing base of the internet, is that I'm everywhere, reading everything, right? Like, I think the Unix people were trying to set up some sort of vuln sharing thing, and eventually they had to turn it off. They're like, people keep reading this. And then they laugh at us in public. It's annoying, right? So, obviously. And the first thing that a real team's going to do is compromise your security IT team and your company. And we've seen this ourselves when we do incident response. They hit the security IT group. And the security IT group, of course, usually runs on the same domain controller as everybody else, right? It's all on the same infrastructure, which I think is very interesting. And so you detect a bunch of data loss, but you haven't classified any of your data, so you have no idea how big the impact is or how far it spreads or what it's really about, which I think is funny. And then as a defender, you're constantly saying that our opponents are retarded. Therefore, you underestimate what they can actually do and how much they're willing to spend against you and everything about them. And all your money is in stuff from the 90s, basically. If it has a signature in it, it's from the 90s. Or if it has a network tap, for example. If you've done that, then of course you're losing, right? So none of this is inherent in the cyber domain. You don't have to be dumb, right? But just because you are doesn't mean you have to do it in the future, right? You don't have to keep buying antivirus. I know, I'll put a big parser on it. That will solve it. There's a lot of this stuff people say it is asymmetric because they have made the wrong strategic choice and lost. It's like saying chess is asymmetric, but it's not true, right? So here's the basic conclusions that you end up deriving when you think of things as non-asymmetric, right? What you do is you get calls for much more regulation of the internet and of all networks, and it's just never going to happen because it's a big problem, right? It moves glacially. By the time they figure out what to regulate, it's going to be gone. We're all going to be using our brain interface or whatever. And people assume that the current asymmetricness, the current offense seems to be winning feature of the internet is built in, which it's not. And this is a danger for attackers as well, because attackers can also get lulled into a false sense of security, so to speak, right? You can think, I have the advantage because I'm smarter. And that's not true either, right? You have the advantage because you got lucky, you know, and the current field is on your side, but that changes quick, especially in this industry. And even now, the cost of attack is a lot higher than people realize. And it's only going to go up. And I think the policy that people create around this, obviously, is right now it's sort of funny because they're like, it is asymmetric, therefore we're going to design in 10 years or in perpetuity for asymmetricity and for non-kinetics, which is also not true, et cetera, et cetera. But the cool thing about that is it makes it not their fault, right? If it's asymmetric, then when you lose, it's not your fault. But if it is your fault, you just made a bad strategic choice, then you have to pay the price. And it'd be good if you got surprised a bit less. Currently, most people are making their strategic decisions about security without any experience as attackers. And this is even true in the academic community, right? Like, we write papers about static analysis based on, bug classes that have been dead for 5 years. I don't know. I guess we're going up the chain somehow. But it is a very young phenomenon. Even by, I guess computing standpoint, security has matured kind of quickly in the last few years. And Mudge and Jeff Moss, and there's a few people in trying to push through government for a while. But it's probably going to be about 20 years until our policy is written by, the traditional men with beards that do this sort of thing and who, of course, have experience in it. And I wanted to point out that, people look at it as attacking cities, as attacking nation states, but LulzSec and all the other people have shown you, Wikipedia especially, or WikiLeaks and all the other stuff, that it's not necessarily the institutions that you most think are going to be under attack that are really most vulnerable. Cyber war attacks ideology. It doesn't necessarily attack structures the way everything else attacks. And a nation state is a kind of ideology, right? If your nation state cannot protect you from your business going under, then obviously it's not doing the job for you. That puts a certain pressure on the nation state, right? That's how nation states fall, is they cannot protect you. Therefore, you have to make other deals. And in general, it ends up being powerful in a different way because it's essentially a weapon of mass disruption, which is a different kind of beast from something that you have to destroy things with, right? If I can make your religion disappear, and I think that's a very interesting thing that Anonymous attacked Scientology first, right? And Scientology is probably one of the more difficult targets for that because they're very active in their defense. But any of the older religions is much more at risk, right? Or news organizations, or pick a ideology rather than a structure, an organization. And because the people are still playing these games out, this stuff's going to get used, right? It got used in Stuxnet. People say, hey, I can hit this button. Let's see what it does, right? That's, you keep doing it until you get hurt. And there's things you can do. And I'm going to focus as a company because there's people who have companies that want to do things. And you can make better strategic decisions. You can just say no to certain platforms. You can say just say no to SSL VPNs. Just say no to PHP. Just say no to all sorts of things that you know are not able to be secured at all. And again, your outsourcing, who you hire, all these things have to start playing into it because security is not just about computers. Which means at some point you have to classify your data. You have to know, okay, this is an IT security administrator's workstation. It has the following things of data. They're classified at the following corporate levels. And when I lose that whole workstation, here's what I've really lost. That's a very tough problem. And of course, there's nation states. And I'm not really speaking for our nation state, obviously. They don't love me too much. But people look at strategic deterrence as probably the only viable option in this space. I think they're probably right. There's this great slide from Global Security where they show what strategic deterrence on the world's oceans took. And so when you measure carriers, you measure them by deck space. And these are to scale. So you can say United States has X deck space, which is quite a hard thing to say on a microphone. But the that's a lot bigger than, say, Spain's, right? So if you look at the kind of scale that you get here, you know, compared to any of the others, it's quite large. That's kind of what you're going to start seeing when you want to start solving the attribution problem, right? You're going to be spending X percent more, and this may not be possible as a single nation state, right? You may end up having to spend X percent more as a team to solve the attribution problem. I think, honestly, all this stuff, despite the hype, right? We were talking earlier about how every time you say cyber, what you really are saying is hype. But I think, despite the hype, I think this stuff is still very much underrated in importance, right? At the point where you aren't spending as much as you are on your Navy, you're probably not spending enough, right? Because cryptographics in the modern world is a subset of your cyber capabilities, right? And people right now think of it as the other way around. Or they're like, cyber, well, maybe that'll get us some good crypto information. But it's very much the other way. Cyber is a much bigger plate to eat from. And I'm hoping that some of this was true, maybe even a large percentage of it. But I know it's not going to make you free. So I'm going to open the floor to debate and hilarious comments about how smart you are now.
Yeah, hi Dave, it's Rick Farrow. So, I thought of lots of questions I could ask, but debate and so on. But I guess two things stick with me. Now, you said SDL, you mean software development? What SDL means?
It's the security development lifecycle stuff.
Security development
lifecycle. There's a whole like book on this from Microsoft.
Okay, I'm sorry. Awesome. Yeah, I'm not much of a Microsofty. Yeah, and platforms. I mean, that doesn't seem like there are any secure platforms. I mean, maybe you'll pick OpenBSD because it's obscure and they used to pay a lot of attention, and they still seem to pay a lot of attention to obscurity. But what are the applications? I mean, that's really the bottom line. People want to run this. You can't toss all the applications and say, okay, use OpenBSD.
Well, you can. You just use Chrome OS instead, which is a much more secure platform.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. And then finally, on asymmetry, another way of looking at it as the defender has to fix all possible holes and the attacker needs to find one. And that seems to be another way of looking at asymmetry.
Yeah, that's not really true though.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's really hard to exploit ASLR. You have to worky.
Yeah, okay. Well, that was sort of
so you can fix your whole platform the same way you can fix anything.
Ah, okay. Earlier on, you were saying 18 hours to exploit for a particular exploit, and then you said 451 hours. And that's really, if you find an exploit, you have to weaponize. You actually have to make it work with something like ASLR to make it effective. And that's where most of the time is, right?
Well, 18 hours is when I actually have to run the exploit. It takes 18 hours from when I hit enter to when I get a shell.
Ah, I see. Sorry, I missed that. Okay. Yeah. So 451 hours. So that's
was our average time for finding and exploiting a bug.
Right, and isn't most of that actually you find a bug, and then actually most of the time it's actually figuring out how you can gain control over the PC.
It's the whole process, including writing large documents about it, which without, you know, you aren't a real serious player in the business. You know, we sell a product called Canvas where we've done this for hundreds of exploits, which is how we get these numbers. But we don't use the term weaponized because using terms like that is how governments decide to regulate you. No, it's not funny when it's
your neck
in the noose, but
I understand.
You know, we QA them.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thanks, Dave.
So, if government policymakers, people in the Pentagon, you know, the security, you know, people that have companies that get paid lots of money to provide security for their clients, have these fundamental misunderstandings about cyber war that you are setting the record straight on, how should they change their approach to what they do? What are the practical implications for how these men and women should approach their jobs?
Well, I think that's going to be a massive question. I'll give another 3-hour talk on that, possibly.
Can you just kind of summarize it in three sentences?
I guess I think just say no is a good summarization for, I mean, at a corporate level, it's very easy to do, right? If you, you know, very few corporations have the organization structure now, which will say all new things we buy, we run through a security team. If it doesn't meet our mark, the security team can neg it, right? That's a very painful thing to do for an organization, but you have to have that if you're going to move forward in any secure way. And I think governments probably scale up from there, right? I mean, there's no reason you have NT on all your warships. Is there? Or maybe there is a reason. I don't know. Did it pass your security review? Perhaps it did. So I think these policy decisions are going to get made, you know, under, if you assume it's not asymmetric, what does that change? Does that change how much money you put in? Does it change what technologies you invest in? It might. I would hope so.
So people, you would put in more or less money?
Well, for example, I would say if I'm not a big country, I would have to team up, right? That's the first thing I would change, right? Like if I'm a country with a, you know, if I'm Angola, then I need a team or I'm going to get run over.
Right.
Okay. So that's the first step.
Right. The second and last question is, you gave a lot of examples in the mid and end part of your talk about just almost inherently insecure platforms that people refuse to move away from. And I'm trying to understand how that doesn't contradict your other point that essentially the attacker really only has to get one thing right, and you know, the defender has to get, you know, essentially everything right. I mean, doesn't all of these insecurities and the fact that the defenders are just repeatedly getting the snot knocked out of them on a daily basis, doesn't that essentially reinforce the idea that the attackers are out there making really impressive wins pretty much on a daily basis?
Well, that's the illusion, right? I mean, but obviously the defenders can make the decision not to run this crap. And that's a very easy one to make if they want to.
No, it's not.
Okay, it's not easy for him.
I work for Dollar Bank.
He works for Dollar Bank.
And I will tell you that until being insecure costs us more money than being secure does, we won't be secure.
Okay.
And this is a political and financial layer problem. And given regulatory requirements, which are, you know, not real, they're all kind of silly. Look at socks, right, and laugh.
So you have
it costs us less money to get broken into than it does to be secure. That's the bottom line.
Okay.
And until that changes, I don't see any of this ever changing.
I don't know. That does cost you less money. I mean, you basically use the same excuses that I think I listed that excuse here. Hold on. Let me scroll in. Ooh, you say I have resource constraints, right?
It's not resource constraints. We could do it. I'm saying that if you look at the bottom line, as long as we're quarterly based, you know, how much money do we make this quarter for our investors, we will make more money per quarter in the short to medium term by doing things that are quick time to market and insecure than by being secure.
Well,
until the financial incentives change or we're not no longer capitalists, I don't see this getting fixed unless there are regulatory requirements that become, you know, useful and sane and actually like force us to.
And if you think about everything by the quarter, by literally 3 months, then that may be your only option. So
the market does quarter by quarter.
The market does stocks quarter by quarter, he says. It sometimes does.
So, Dave, I was really glad to hear this presentation because you're actually validating my research.
Awesome.
The radio stuff is just kind of a detour, but I'm actually a metrics person.
Okay.
And we had been looking at the learning curve, the attacker learning curve, and what we found is very similar to your, well, actually the same. It takes a very long time to develop that first 0 day. The rate of expectation speeds up afterward, probably because of the learning curve and you've developed tools and things like that. But pretty much the time from release to first O-Day is the longest time you're going to get. And the other recommendation that we kept giving people was basically throw your code out and start over. But they don't listen.
So. Well, I think people look at release to first O-Day, and is that the first O-Day that they catch with their broken IDS?
Well, first publicly released.
First publicly released O-Day. When does that happen?
Yeah, it's hard to tell. But
see, there's no good data. This is the thing with metrics that I think, you know, I've been on the security metrics list for a long time.
Me too.
And there's zero good data, right? He constantly is like, well, if only we had good data, we'd have some good metrics. But we don't have any data at all, right? Like,
yeah,
and that's happened for the past 4 years on that list, and I think it will probably happen for the next 4 years.
All we can do is kind of a best of. There's, you
know, yeah. Yeah. I think this is, it's interesting to try to figure it out because, you know, people look at that time between release of product and then release of an O-Day. The reality, all you're measuring is the time that it took someone to get caught because they developed the O-Day on the beta, right, before it went to gold, ideally. Because they probably have full source code of the product and they owned the actual company and they have access to everything, including the security team's, you know, assessments of the product and what they decided not to fix. So there's a lot there. Metrics are tough in this industry. I think if you don't have data, it's really hard, but they're really cool.
Hey, Dave. Adam. So I agree with the majority of your points. It's kind of weird talking to a mic. So in the academia side, it's kind of slow and tedious to bring students up with the expertise that you need to be a very, very acute attacker. Building a, like you said, it takes you hundreds of hours to build out the tools, identify the O-Day, and...
Well, then you should stop playing EVE Online. What can I say?
But from an academic perspective, what kind of suggestions could you make for building out programs that are actually effective at making people more intelligent attackers?
I don't know. That's straight up. Like, attackers are basically crazy people. So... Because you have to be successful, right? It's a combination of paranoia, OCD, and a bunch of other stuff. You know, most of them are slightly manic depressive. This makes them fun to manage, by the way. And I include myself in this description as well. I'm no exemplary nature there. But I don't know why the academic community isn't producing more of them than it is. I think it does produce plenty. I think you probably don't know who they are, right? I mean, you know, they're out there. They're just not writing papers in, like, weird format that don't work, right? They're not doing academic security research, but they are doing security research, you know, on your network somewhere far away. Plenty of good people out there. So that was my talk. I noticed no one else has any questions, which is good. But if you have questions later, I'll be happy to answer them. Or maybe I will just make funny jokes like I did here. About stuff. So thank you for having me, and thanks for your time.